It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Research suggests children's natural curiosity in science begins to decline around the fourth grade. How can we keep them engaged and nurture their natural sense of wonder? It's a question central to Jason Brown's new promotion. He joined the Carnegie Science Center in 2014 and just last month was named its permanent director. Jason, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
You stepped into the interim role of director when the previous co-directors, Ron Bailey and Ann Metzger, retired in December of 2018. You've been in the interim position for a while. Does being named permanent director give you more freedom to do what you envision for the Science Center?
I think to some degree it does, although we have a wonderful team anyway, and they were incredibly supportive from day one. So as soon as I came in, everyone stepped up to ask how they could help to move the Science Center forward into the future.
All right. When you're thinking about moving it forward, and when you think, what if, or could we, what's going through your mind?
I think that the most important thing we need to address as an industry, but also as a science center specifically, is what if we could create a science center that was welcoming and relevant to every single person in Pittsburgh? What if we talked about the things that matter most to the people here, but what if they also felt like there was a piece of them reflected in our exhibitions and in our programs and in the people that they met?
Mm-hmm. Do you have those answers to all those questions?
No, if I did, I think I would have been promoted a lot earlier.
Before joining the Carnegie Science Center, you taught middle school, high school, even college courses. How did your time in those classrooms set the stage for your work in this much larger classroom, Carnegie's sort of giant laboratory, if you will?
Well, I started teaching in 1993, and I realized pretty fast that there was a focus by the administrations and also by the policymakers that there was a focus more on content rather than process and skills. So I tried to create classes where my students were given the opportunity to be active learners, to take what they had done and apply it. So it wasn't just about memorization. I think that one of the fundamental problems that we're seeing with education is that there is such a push for content. And when students spend 12 years as passive learners, and then we put them into the workforce where they're forced to be active participants and thinkers and problem solvers, it's sort of a disconnect, and they are not as prepared as they could be going forward. So I really think that education is now starting to move towards this idea of developing skills in the students and not just memorization of content.
We're moving away from science as just being knowledge and rather hands-on interaction?
Well, and I hope so. And I think that that's what STEM really encompasses. STEM isn't just about those four subject areas of science, technology, engineering, math. It's about the skills that enable you to be successful in those areas. So, for example, it's critical thinking, it's problem solving, it's artistic expression of your ideas, it's teamwork and collaboration, it's analytical skills and looking at evidence and being able to articulate the conclusions that you have. So it's all of those things that enable you to be dropped into any position, really, and be able to look at the problems and think your way out of it.
So specifically, how do you do it? How do you keep kids engaged so that they hold on to that natural curiosity and it doesn't wane?
Well, I think that, you know, in a lot of the memos you see around the Science Center, you'll see the phrase hands-on activities, and that is quite literally what we do. We give them the opportunity to get hands-on with science. So it's not just about learning the concepts, but it's about the opportunity to try things out, see how they work, fail, try again. And I think that's another big piece of what we do is it's a safe space to learn. So it's not doing it once and being successful or failing and being done. It's looking at your results and then making iterations and changes and trying again. And I think that that's what the Science Center does really, really well, is give our visitors the opportunity to take a shot and see if it works. And if it does, great. And if it doesn't, take another shot until it does work.
Are you ever surprised at what sparks a child's interest?
Yes, because I think I'll always be surprised by that. I think it's different for everyone. I know that I had certainly, there are very vivid memories from my childhood that are what I think inspired me into science today. And I think that those vary from person to person.
And do you use those childhood memories to help you create and say what we can do today, years later, at this Carnegie Science Center?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. You know, I think about my chemistry class when I was a kid. And so in 11th grade, I took chemistry and I remember learning about acids and bases and how they react. And so my best friend Jim and I, on our way home from school that day, were talking about it and we realized that ammonia was an acid and Drano was a bass. And so if you put them together, you should get some kind of reaction. So we went home to his house and found a glass mayonnaise jar in the basement, mixed them together and dropped it in the driveway and watched what happened. And that was one of those really formative moments where I realized that I loved science and you could see what you could actually do with it.
So you're a big believer that science education should be, must be fun.
It doesn't have to be fun.
Okay. It would be great.
It certainly can be fun. I think it should be fun. Mm-hmm. I don't think it has to be fun. And it isn't always fun, but I think you can make almost anything about science fun.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Jason Brown about his new role as executive director of the Carnegie Science Center. For about a decade, the Science Center has been developing various STEM programs. Jason, do you believe that the center has a role, maybe even an obligation, to ease inequities in science education for students?
Absolutely. I think that there are fundamental differences between the opportunities provided to students of different neighborhoods, different socioeconomic levels. And I think the Science Center really provides the opportunity to level that. And I feel it's our obligation to do that. I think that we need to give kids the opportunity to experience and appreciate science in a way that some schools do and some schools don't. So we're really there to fill in the gap.
How do you achieve it?
Well, we have a lot of on-site programs. We have student STEM programs that run throughout the year. Our next one coming up is called STEM Adventure, and it's for students in elementary school to get them inspired about science and also connect them with the professionals in Pittsburgh who are doing real science. We have the Pittsburgh Regional Science and Engineering Fair, where we'll have nearly 1,000 students who are participating in original research, and that takes place at the Science Center also later this month. But we have outreach programs like Science on the Road and our mobile Fab Lab that takes programming out to schools as well. Because one thing we found is that sometimes the most prohibitive thing to schools coming to visit us is not the cost of admission, but it's the cost of buses. Mm. So if we can bring programming to them and meet them where they are in their neighborhood, I think that really provides a much greater opportunity to reach more people and more students.
I want to talk about a few exhibits. There are several permanent ones like Robo World. I think it's as popular with adults and guardians as it is with kids. But I understand that you're a triathlete. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So is your favorite sports works, you know, where you can pitch, you can climb, you can jump, you can run. So is that it or not?
Well, I do love sports works. I think that it's a great place. It's a ton of fun. There's a lot of great science in there. But my personal favorite is actually the Miniature Railroad and Village, which is celebrating its centennial this year.
Yes.
I am not an original Pittsburgher. So for me, I love seeing what Pittsburgh has looked like in the past. And my father-in-law is from Denora. And the first time he came and visited the Science Center, we were looking at the Forbes Field part of the Miniature Railroad and Village. And he was pointing to the right fielder saying, well, that's got to be Roberto Clemente because he was the only one that could throw in the air from right field without a bounce. And he pointed to the right field bleachers and said, that's where, you know, my wife and I used to sit when we would come here. So it's just I think there's a connection to everyone who's been around Pittsburgh for a while to something on the Miniature Railroad. And I think that that's really special.
Well, somebody who is not native yourself and somebody who is native myself, that is my favorite as well. So the Mummies of the World exhibit. Now, this is not a permanent. It's actually ending April 19th. Right?
Correct.
All right. When you're planning ahead, what do you look for in a marquee exhibit, just something that might excite adults and kids?
I think we're looking to diversify our audience. We bring a lot to the Science Center, and there's a lot of people that come, and mostly families. But what we want to show is that there's something there for everyone. So by having something like Mummies of the World, it brings in an audience who may otherwise not be coming to the Science Center. So that's what we certainly look for, that to broaden our audience, which is what Mummies has done.
Right.
But we also want to make sure we're not doing the same thing over and over again. So we want, for example, Mummies is filled with antiquity, whereas our next one will be animatronic dinosaurs. So that's totally different.
Uh-oh.
So
we want to make me on that one.
We want to make sure that we're mixing it up and doing things differently each time because we want it to be new and fresh, and that's the idea of the traveling exhibition.
And to attract new people to
Correct.
The center. I
exactly.
mean, you're the you have hundreds of thousands every year.
Yes, over 500,000 on site. And what we really want to, one of the things that I'm really focused on going forward is that I want to be focused on science first, but I want to be focused on relevance and a connection to the people here. I want to be talking about things and showing things and exhibiting things that are meaningful to the people who live in Pittsburgh.
Just a couple minutes left. Do you look to other centers around the country for inspiration?
We actually have a tremendous network of science centers, not only in the country, but globally. We're a member of an organization called the Association of Science Technology Centers. It's ASTEC for short. And in fact, we're hosting the annual International ASTEC Conference here in Pittsburgh. We're the host organization. Their board of directors and their conference planning committee are here as we speak at the Carnegie Science Center developing that conference. So we certainly are very well connected and networked with that group, because we all draw from one another. And what's amazing about this industry is that we all share with each other. It's not competitive. It's very collaborative. So if we have a great idea and someone else is interested in it, we just give them all the information to try and replicate it, and vice versa.
Jamie, I saw a photo of you wearing a T-shirt that says science is greater than, using the mathematical greater than sign opinion. Science obviously excites you. Do you get frustrated when it comes under attack, say, even in the political arena?
I do, actually. I as a scientist, I'm a physicist by training. Mm-hmm. I base a lot of my decisions on sort of an objective, what I believe to be an objective perspective. And I think that the problem that has arisen is that it's being used for political purposes, and it's being held up as if science itself has the agenda instead of those who are using it for those purposes. So science is one of those things that if you accept it, you kind of have to accept it as it is. You can't pick and choose the pieces of science that you want to believe. You can't choose that my cell phone works because of science, but I don't want to accept this other commonly held science fact because I don't like the way it fits. You got to kind of take it all or take none of it.
Okay. Science Center opened in 1991. The city is really different now, nearly 30 years later, in a couple sentences. Do you see its role in the community changing or evolving under your direction?
Well, I think it's always evolving because the city itself is evolving. But I would say the biggest focus going forward is that we want to make sure that everybody can come to the Science Center. Everybody feels welcome at the Science Center. We are really focused on equity. We're focused on inclusion and access and diversity. And we are developing internal systems, trainings, and processes to make sure that we are creating a welcoming environment for everyone.
Jason Brown is the new director of the Carnegie Science Center. Jason, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Stocks plunged and then jumped, and then the Fed cut interest rates. We'll sort out how this could have affected your money. And Pennsylvanians didn't vote on Super Tuesday, but their choices at the end of April have likely been impacted by it. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Send your suggestions to confluence@wesa.fm. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Avery College in Allegheny City, now the North Side, is founded in 1849. Originally called Allegheny Institute and Mission Church, the school was designed to educate the city's African-American students. It was established by Methodist preacher and philanthropist Charles Avery, who also used the institution as a hiding spot for runaway slaves on the Underground Railroad. It taught prominent Pittsburghers who would go on to found other higher education institutions, become bankers, and lead social movements. It closed in 1914. There's still a marker commemorating the site at Avery and Nash Streets. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Rural America has an internet problem, and Pennsylvania is not immune. By some estimates, most of the state doesn't get high-speed broadband internet. In many areas, neither the government nor the industry is in a hurry to fix the issue. But as Keystone Crossroads' Min Sheehan reports, that's prompted a ragtag group of DIYers in rural Huntington County to come up with their own solution.
Ice and snow covered the top of Stone Mountain in Huntington County after a recent winter storm. But one thing stood out, a 120-foot-tall tower that can be seen from both sides of the mountain.
This is it.
We made it, didn't we?
That radio tower is a point of pride to Ken Devon. He's one of the founding members of the Rural Broadband Cooperative, a group with a goal of bringing high-speed internet to the sparsely populated area about halfway between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh. Walking up to the tower, he pointed out its power source.
Of course, you know what that is. That's our solar panel. That's what creates
or makes our electricity to run our equipment.
These solar panels not only power the tower, but the equipment room underneath it. This mountaintop operation is key in what's called a fixed wireless broadband connection. It taps into an existing underground fiber optic network and then turns it into a radio signal.
Now, what you see here, this dish here, is aiming at our other dish down in Allensville. And that's where we're getting our internet from.
From there, the cooperative relays the internet to its users who have radio receivers at home that connect to a router. Compared to expensive infrastructure like telephone or cable lines, this is much cheaper. Companies have long complained that providing service to rural areas like this is a money-losing business. Divin says state and federal representatives have offered very little help.
They keep looking at the big businesses to solve it for them, Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and those people aren't going to do it. It costs too much money unless there's a population of 40, 50 homes or 100 homes, then it's profitable for them to do it. They're not going to do it for us.
He says at a meeting where townspeople gather to learn about options, Comcast named the price, $80,000 to build 6 miles of cable wire that would serve a handful of households. Divin remembered that meeting was where the cooperative group first met.
So we looked at it, we're going to take care of ourselves.
Henry McCreary is the president of the cooperative.
So we have people with, you know, that are crane operators, welders, carpenters, business people, all coming together to try to make this happen.
A retired telecommunications manager, he says the issues caused by the lack of reliable broadband are ubiquitous.
It hurts the local economy. You know, if people are going to move in this area, and a lot of people like to work from home now, or you want to locate your business in this area without viable internet service, a lot of people are impaired from being able to do such things.
He says the cooperative is a volunteer-run nonprofit, not only to keep costs down, but also because the feeling of ownership means a lot to the group.
This is a grassroots operation. The team decided that we're going to do it ourselves and build it and operate our own network without the help of outside parties.
McCreary says the cooperative is the only of its kind in the state. He says he believes it's a repeatable solution for other communities. But there is one significant limit.
You've got to have a direct line of sight between the radio dish receiver at a person's home and the tower. So living here in rural Pennsylvania where there's a lot of tall trees and hills in the ways, we can't always easily get into people's homes.
Ken Devin was connected to the new service at the end of November. It wasn't quite broadband, but it was close, a big improvement.
Download is 22.04 megabits per second. Upload was 2.74 megabits per second. That's pretty good.
This summer, the Rural Broadband Cooperative will build a second radio tower. Tom Bracken, a volunteering member, will be waiting to connect to it.
I mean, it wasn't easy for us to get it done, but it certainly wasn't a multi-million dollar effort. You know, when you can put up a tower that can serve 1,000 people for $50,000, that's really all you need. It's just one of those towers on every mountaintop around the area, and you're good to go, you know.
Amin Shen, Keystone Crossroads.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Wall Street opened minutes ago. What direction might it take? And how have Pittsburgh investors been affected by a tumultuous week in response to the spreading coronavirus? Let's put those questions to Jamie Meredith, Senior Vice President at Pittsburgh-based Heffron Tillotson. Good morning, Jamie.
Good morning.
So help me understand. Big drops on Wall Street last week, then a record increase on Monday of 1,290 points. Yesterday, a loss of 785 points. The outlier seems to be Monday. Why the surge then?
Well, it's, you know, it's enough to make anybody nervous, these wild gyrations in the market. And the market's trying to interpret the news. We had a really, really bad week last week. A lot of the kind of realization that the coronavirus is very, very infectious and it may be very, very disruptive to the economy sent the markets down. But then we got some good news that maybe it wasn't so bad. There were some rumors that the Fed will cut interest rates. The Fed actually came out on Friday, said we're going to do all that it takes to we're going to use every tool in our toolbox to stabilize the economy. That helped people calm themselves over the weekend. Monday staged a big, big rally. But then yesterday, when the Fed actually did what it said it was going to do, it kind of spooked the markets, kind of scared the markets a little bit. The Fed pulled back a little bit from their earlier talk. And then we had another wild gyration down. But this morning, Dow's up about 500 points, so it might be a good day today. But I'll let you know at 5 o'clock where the market's closed at 4 o'clock.
Okay. So it hadn't had its intended effect, the Fed cutting the interest rate, at least not yet. What's your...
No, I think...
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that's part of the rally for today, that people realized, hey, this is a good thing. But yesterday, it kind of cut the markets off guard, and the markets were like a little surprised that the Fed was cutting early and thought maybe the Fed knows something that the market doesn't. So there was that big sell-off.
So what's your advice to investors right now? Buy, sell, hold the course?
Well, the best advice is don't panic. If you have a diversified portfolio, if you're 401k, if you don't have 100% of your money in emerging markets, if you've got a lot of different color crayons in your crayon box, you're going to be okay. You're going to, again, get a little nauseous from these wild rides, but we're thinking 6 months, all of this will be behind us and we'll be worried about the election. So again, long-term investors really shouldn't worry. Folks that maybe have taken some outside bets in their portfolio, they've loaded up on some really, really risky things, they may want to pull back. This could be an opportunity to pull back. Folks that are taking income, well, they may want to not reinvest dividends. They may want to have those dividends and interest paid to them in cash. That will hopefully allow them to not sell as many shares, which could be sold in a down day. But the number one thing, don't panic.
If you're in a buying mood, is it too late to get in on the low? Does it depend on your age, how close you are to retirement versus several years left in the market?
Yeah, I think it really depends if you're a long-term investor and there's a number of years before you need the funds. I think this is a good time, if you have some cash on the sidelines, to put it in the market. We may not be at the bottom, where we do anticipate some more volatile days, and they could be very, very high swings. As our infection rate continues to climb, that may spook the market again. But again, our baseline is in several months, this virus will run its course and it'll be business as usual. So I think for a patient investor who's comfortable with these volatility swings, I think the next dip, I would advise folks, yeah, you can buy some things on sale.
All right, about 90 seconds left. Some Pittsburgh-based companies took a big hit yesterday. As Pittsburghers, should we be worried about our own?
Well, I think any small city that has smaller companies, those companies are at greater risk. If you see it, think of a big, gigantic company like Apple Computer, they have $200 billion sitting in cash, so they can weather a lot of storms. A smaller company, let's pick on U.S. Steel, they've had some hard times. And if their production slows down, if their sales slow down, they may not have the same access to borrowing, cheap borrowing, that larger companies do. So smaller companies are going to sell off a little bit more because they do face more risks than those big behemoths.
Right. In a sentence or two, Jamie, what other locally based companies are you keeping an eye on in addition to U.S. Steel or PNC Financial, which was down 5%?
Right. We've got a lot of great companies in our area. We've got 2-6, we've got American Eagle, we've got Dick's Sporting Goods, we've got Allegheny Technologies, we've a little further out, we've got Kennametal. We've got some really, really world-class companies in our area. Again, those companies aren't the big giant behemoths, but they are very, very good companies for what they do. And you know, when the tide comes out of the bay, all of the ships are going to sink. But when the tide comes back in, only the boats with holes in their bows are going to stay on the bottom. So these good quality companies, they're going to recover.
Jamie Meredith is the Senior Vice President for Heffern Tillotson. Thanks so much, Jamie.
Absolutely. Great to talk to you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania's primary is still 8 weeks away. But there are lessons to be gleaned from a wild week in national politics. What impact do the results from Super Tuesday have on Pennsylvania? We turn to the editor of WESA's government accountability team, Chris Potter. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
So, Chris, the race for 1991 continues. That's 1,991 delegates to win the nomination.
Yeah, that's right. There's about 4,000 at all in all that are available to Democratic candidates, and about a third of them were at issue yesterday on Super Tuesday.
So which, briefly, your take on what happened Super Tuesday?
Well, I can kind of only echo the conventional wisdom, which is this is suddenly becoming a lot closer to a two-person race between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. And I think the turnaround that Joe Biden has exhibited in recent days, especially after his primary win in South Carolina, has been really the story of this campaign so far.
Are we waiting to see if Elizabeth Warren and Michael Bloomberg will reassess campaigns?
Yeah, Mr. Bloomberg's campaign last night was saying they're going to take some time to reassess. He was scheduled to come to Pittsburgh, actually, on Thursday.
Oh, you said was. Is that now?
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard from anybody in the campaign, but they had put out a few statements saying he's coming to Pittsburgh Thursday afternoon. They didn't have a location. But apparently the campaign is reassessing. He spent a lot of money for not much payoff, not much ROI, as they say in his line of work, on Tuesday.
In February, 8 candidates filed to get on the ballot for the Pennsylvania Democratic primary.
Yeah.
What's your guess? How many will still have active campaigns when Pennsylvanians actually vote?
Well, it'd be a fool who tries to guess the heart of Tulsi Gabbard, I think. It's very difficult to see how Mr. Bloomberg or, in fact, Elizabeth Warren continues here. Ms. Warren had a very disappointing night. She finished third in her own home state of Massachusetts here. So it remains to be seen the decisions there. But I think if you're looking at this race, this feels a lot like 2016 felt to Democrats. By the time it gets to Pennsylvania, it was very much a sort of war of attrition between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and it feels like much the same dynamic shaping up, at least as we sit here today. I don't want to make predictions because we have seen anybody who tries to predict anything in this race looks like an idiot.
Can the remaining candidates, like Biden, count on votes from people who chose Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, say, before they exited the race? Would Biden's folks look at those votes and think, well, at least this many will swing our way since we got those former candidates' endorsements?
Yeah, I mean, certainly they're going to be hoping for that, right? And it's very clear that Senator Klobuchar's support of Mr. Biden helped deliver Minnesota, a state where he was not expected to win just a few days ago, came out and won. It was one of the bigger results of the night, although not one of the biggest states. You know, they have been less, Ms. Klobuchar, less of a factor in Pennsylvania, obviously, than her own home state. And voters tend to kind of make up their own minds about this kind of stuff, especially if there's not a strong bind to them. And there wouldn't be such a strong bind. But if you're Joe Biden, you're thinking Amy Klobuchar, she came to Pittsburgh once or twice, did well with some of the unions just in terms of, you know, going and talking to members of the Carpenters Union. And I've got that same kind of lane in a place like Western Pennsylvania that I hope to kind of work.
Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden have been in Pennsylvania a few times, but not recently. As candidates swing through, Where do you expect them to show up? What areas?
Yeah, I mean, for one thing, I expect to see both of those candidates and anybody else still in the race. In early April, the AFL-CIO, the state AFL-CIO, was going to have a convention in Philadelphia. They have moved that convention to Pittsburgh because of a labor dispute involving the venue that was supposed to host them. I have a very strong sense that we will be seeing those candidates here in Pittsburgh for that event and some other ones in Western Pennsylvania, too. This is a big, big area, especially come November, and anything they can do to kind of to shore up their support here helps them both in the primary, but then most importantly in the fall.
In our last 30 seconds, what issues do you expect them to hit upon that could resonate with Pennsylvanians?
I mean, I expect Bernie Sanders to continue being Bernie Sanders. I expect him to be sounding the themes he has been sounding really for the past 5 years about sort of the deck being stacked against working people. And similarly, I expect Joe Biden to try to consolidate this moment to talk about Democrats having to come together. He'll be making an overture to moderate Republicans and talking about himself as a candidate who can bring us back to the way things were. And I think those are the two messages we're going to hear. Revolution versus let's just get back to where we were 5 years ago before Donald Trump became the president.
And speaking of Donald Trump, President Trump will be on the other side of the state very soon.
Yeah, in an area where he expects to do well and really helped power his surprising win in the state in 2016 for sure.
Chris Potter is the government accountability editor for WESA. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.